I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer Armistead Maupin. He's joined in conversation by Peter Stein. And now, join Maggie Grabmeier on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Armistead Maupin and Peter Stein.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Chag Sameach, happy National Coming Out Day. I'm Maggie Grabmeier. So National Coming Out Day was started almost 30 years ago as a way for queer people to challenge homophobia and transphobia. It was a call for oppressed people to be brave, come out, and take up space to help create a more accepting world for others in the LGBTQ community. This year, National Coming Out Day falls during the Harvest Festival of Sukkot. We celebrate Sukkot as a time that encourages us to dwell in joy and be thoughtful about how we create, nourish, and care for our homes at every level, locally and globally. Armistead Maupin is an esteemed writer, gay activist, and San Francisco icon. In 1976, he launched his groundbreaking Tales of the City serial in the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's since gone on to write 9 novels, including the 6-volume Tales of the City series. He's here tonight to celebrate his long-awaited debut memoir, Logical Family, which tells the story of his childhood in North Carolina, his military service in Vietnam, and his early years as a young San Franciscan, finding community with his chosen family. Armistead Maupin is joined tonight by our friend Peter Stein, producer and director, and one of the JCCSF's favorite onstage interviewers. Please give a warm welcome to Armistead Maupin and Peter Stein.
Happy Sukkot.
Yeah, thank God I got the right pronunciation of that to explain to me.
I think it means drag in Hebrew, from what I understand. And I have to say, given that incredible prelude, we are woefully underdressed for tonight.
Really, we both went into panic backstage. It was too bad we'd have a little something-something we could wear.
Maybe afterwards we'll reveal. I was going to ask you to read something right off the bat, but instead, before we do that, I do have to ask you, have you ever done drag, and do you have a drag name?
I don't have a drag name, but I did do drag in 1981 at Halloween here. My friend Charles Bush, who was not known at that point, but has gone on to be a legendary performer in New York, realized I was dating a guy at the time who used a wheelchair, a really good-looking tall guy who used a wheelchair, and Charles said, "Well, there's only one thing you can do." So he got us up as Baby Jane and Blanche. It was really frightening because as soon as it didn't take him long either with me. I mean, it was right there waiting to come out. And Will, my date, was complaining about the Goodwill store not being wheelchair accessible. And I was just, oh, stop being such a diva, you know. And we got into that Baby Jane and Blanche thing. Charles said he looked in the rearview mirror and saw us, and it was horrifying.
I take it this date did not end well.
No, it did. And there's a great picture, of course. And Charles dressed as Lucy and my friend Steve Beery dressed as Ethel. And then, it's not exactly a logical foursome walking down Castro Street. And we were getting all the attention, so they were making bitter Lucy and Ethel remarks behind us.
So your drag name is Baby Jane. I think we've established that.
Is that okay? I'll take it.
Well, welcome, and thank you so much for not just for being here, but for writing the memoir that you have so beautifully titled Logical Family, which has a bit of a story behind it. And I thought maybe just to kind of put us into a little bit of the spell of your writing that you actually maybe could grace us with a reading from the prologue to the book.
Sure.
Just because you're such a great storyteller, and we sometimes in conversation forget that you are a damn great writer. And so maybe we can hear your prose.
When I was a boy in Raleigh, I was afraid of being locked in Oakwood Cemetery overnight. Every Sunday after church, when our blue-tailed white Pontiac cruised through the entrance, I fretted about the sign posted above us, "Gates locked at 6 p.m. I never voiced this fear to my parents, but it hovered over me like a threatening storm cloud all afternoon. What if we lost track of the time? That could easily happen as we plucked dandelions from my grandfather's grave or posed sullenly for Daddy's never-ending slides, rigid as garden gnomes. Our family plot was on a rise with the other nice families, a respectable distance from the gate, so the caretaker, a runny-eyed old man who kept a spittoon in his granite cubbyhole, might overlook us when he left for home. That enormous gate would clang shut, and we would be trapped there all night, eating acorns for survival, drinking dew off the lilies. My brother, my sister, my parents, and me, Cemetery Family Robinson. This was not your usual ghoulish graveyard terror, since I found the cemetery anything but spooky. I loved its winding lanes and tilting stones, the way its pale green dells reflect with pink in the spring. I reveled in its rich hieroglyphics, all those corroding angels and renegade jonquils, the palpable antiquity of the place. This was our family seat, after all, the ground to which I would return someday, permanently planted among my ancestors. So what was so scary about that? Folks in Raleigh might assume it had to do with the way my grandfather had died, but I wouldn't learn about that until later, when I was well into my teens, and the matter of why we came to the cemetery every Sunday would finally be explained. Even then, though, my focus would remain on the writing on the stones, not on what actually lay in the boxes beneath them. Oakwood Cemetery was not just the landscape of our past, but also the very blueprint of our family for years to come. My father would eventually lay out the rules for his children in a self-published family history called Prologue, so named for a famous line in The Tempest, "What is past is prologue." Antonio uses the phrase to explain his intention to commit murder. My father used it to justify bragging about his ancestors, and he murdered the truth more than once in the process. "One thing is certain," the old man wrote after rattling off a roll call of all the lawyers, governors, planners, and generals in our family, "is that wherever one of these men met success, there was a self-effacing and goodly lady by his side." Back then, I was still too young to realize that there would never be a lady by my side, goodly or otherwise. Nor would I have noticed how the old man had summarily reduced his wife and daughter to dutiful handmaidens. I felt only this shapeless longing, an oddly grown-up ennui born of alienation and silence. Some children experience this feeling very early on, long before we learn its name and finally let our headstrong hearts lead the way to true north. We grow up as another species entirely, lone gazelles lost amid the buffalo herd of our closest kin. Sooner or later, though, no matter where in the world we live, we must join the diaspora, venturing beyond our biological family to find our logical one, the one that actually makes sense for us. We have to, if we are to live without squandering our lives. So maybe I was beginning to understand something on those Sunday afternoons in the cemetery. Maybe I sensed I didn't belong there, now or forever, that my true genealogy lay somewhere beyond these gates with another tribe.
So after this remarkable run of, I think, 9 Tales novels and 2 non-tales novels, mm-hmm. You turn to this very different form, which is memoir. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what prompted you. Was it at a moment in your life where you felt that you wanted to actually record what had happened to you?
Oh, I think it's just about being old, you know. I'm 73. It's time. Mm. And I've always been fascinated by the form. And I realized that I could use what I knew already, because I have anecdotalized my life for a long time. So I could just find the stories that I liked the most, and some, of course, come out when you get into that territory, you start remembering things, and then use them in a storytelling way. Building suspense the way I would in a novel. I already did there in the first... You don't know what the hell happened to my grandfather, do you? I had dinner just about this time last year at a gathering where the person seated to my immediate right was Patti Smith. Yeah, I was very excited and scared. She's a very imposing presence. Partially because, by her own acknowledgement, she's socially shy. So she finds it difficult to maintain conversations with people. And so at one point I asked her what I was curious about, because I'd read her amazing memoir, and I said, is there any advice you can give me for writing a memoir? I hate it, by the way, when people ask me questions like that. But she said... don't put anything on down where you can't see the scene in the movie. And I thought that was brilliant and very comforting, because that's what I've done with my work for years. I thought, are they going to stick around? Are they going to be interested in this moment? Is this going to be good? So,
well, and that's the curious thing, because as you say there, and you even sort of do a little disclaimer in your foreword. You have mined much of your own experiences growing up, and particular experiences in San Francisco and coming out, and your relationships. You've mined those for your fiction, and so I'm wondering what the difference is in a way. I would think that as a fiction writer, you would feel very tempted to embellish the stories as they actually happen for the purposes of a memoir. So, was there that tension, or? How did you
to
navigate?
I embellished them when I was using them for fiction. Actually, I don't know the answer to that. Mm. I mean, if I tell you either one, then you'll know what a huge fake I am all the way around. I've always been a storyteller, and there's a moment in the memoir where I'm in the Oval Office with Richard Nixon, and. I told the story to Douglas Brinkley, the famous historian, when he was doing a book about John Kerry some years ago. And he came back to me and said, well, everything pans out. I checked the tapes. I said, the tapes? I must be the only person ever to have dreaded the Nixon tapes, because they proved that I was... embellishing a story. But I said, was it the truth? And he said, well, I give you a lot of credit for being able to write funny stuff, but the real life thing was much funnier than you told me. It had to do with...
I was going
to
ask you to just set up why it was that you were shaking Richard Nixon's hand in the Oval Office.
I had been... I took a group of veterans back to Vietnam to build houses for disabled Vietnamese veterans. It sounds wonderfully noble, doesn't it? But it was all a setup from the White House, specifically the Dirty Tricks Department, which wanted to... Oh, I know, they're dead. Well, one of them isn't, I guess. you're gonna have fun with this book. You make that noise every time somebody nasty comes up.
I think you need to wait to about page 212 to stop hissing.
Yeah. it was a setup for Nixon to look like that he cared about veterans, that he cared about the war, what was happening over there. It was at a time, and the day we were invited there, John Kerry was out on the lawn with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War protesting. So even our invitation there was a stunt. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was a nervous wreck with 10 young men, veterans. He didn't know how to talk to us. And I immediately felt, I like to pull up the slack. That's why I kept talking to Patty Smith, even when she wasn't saying anything at dinner. You kind of want to move things along. So I was telling him stories about what we had to do to set this thing up. And in the middle of it, Nixon said, the Vietnamese women are not all that attractive, but those little dresses, those little ao yais that make them look like little butterflies when they're flying down the street on their bicycles. And I stood there and thought, not only is the President of the United States trying to talk with me, he's telling this story to the only in the room.
So your fears that you were misremembering this conversation were not borne out at all.
It's right there on the damn tapes. It's right there on the tapes.
What I found really touching about the scene as you relate it in the book is that it would be so easy to be sneering at Nixon in your prose. You actually do come through as remembering yourself at that time being sort of, in a way, feeling sorry for him that he was so nervous. And at the same time, you're in a way, you're castigating yourself in the book for having had the politics that you had.
Yeah, I don't know who that guy was. Well, I do know who he was and know how he got there. And I know I was raised to be that person. I was trying to... Nothing made my father happier than the fact that I'd been invited to the White House. I was on my way to San Francisco to take my job at the Associated Press. And staying with this buddy that was also part of that group.
You were on driving across the
country. Driving across the country in my Opel GT. You remember those things? They look a little miniature Corvettes, and you have to lie down to drive it. I totaled it on Russian Hill. I'm not a car person. But I was eating dinner with my friend Tom in this very Norman Rockwell setting when the phone rang, and it was either Ehrlichman or Haldeman. I don't remember which one. Tom's mother came over and said, "It's the White House. They want you there on Tuesday, and they want to know where Armistead Maupin is." And so
they tracked you down on your cross-country trip.
They tracked me down, and tracked Tom down, and I would have missed it entirely. I would have been out on the road somewhere, and I'm so glad I didn't, because it was such a strange, surreal thing. And so I got to call the AP Bureau in San Francisco and say, "I can't report to work on Monday because the president wants to see me in the Oval Office." You can imagine how well that went over with a bunch of liberals in San Francisco.
Well, the story is fascinating, and I want to press a little bit on this notion that you looking back, you can recognize who that person was, but you wrote somewhere, I don't know if it was in the book or elsewhere, that you didn't really like the person that you were, and yet it's a very fond, it's not a self-flagellating memoir. And so how do you reconcile the fact that you were at that point closeted and...
Pro-segregation?
Explain that one.
Old man, my father. The argument was, it'll sound very familiar to any LGBT people in the room, and everybody else for that matter, a businessman should be able to make the rules he wants to make about his place of business. So it was the same argument that the right uses about wedding cakes today. And that's why I know better than anybody what the evil is behind that argument, basically. You know, you get to the core of it, and there's prejudice there. I did it. I made a speech in student legislature about it.
Were you kind of? Just
I love the way you. Your body language is so telling, Peter.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. Just go right ahead and be disgusted. I am. I told you I was too. I mean, I not at the time.
Right.
I was proud of myself, and somebody told me the other day that I from Chapel Hill that I was in the editor of the Daily Tar Heel, which was the newspaper there, said, you know, you were sort of our token conservative.
You're listening to writer Armistead Maupin, whose new memoir is Logical Family. He's joined in conversation by Peter Stein on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And 2 years ago, I was given an honorary doctoral degree at Chapel Hill in letters. I was very proud of it and really happy that it gave it to me. And I stood up for this group of teachers and distinguished alumni and said, do you remember when I used to work for Jesse Helms? At the TV station in Raleigh, and it sucked the air out of the room. And it's kind of like they never get it right about me. I mean, they were recognizing me for LGBT things,
right?
You know,
not for your work for Jesse.
Not
Helms.
For that.
Yeah.
But I have. Maybe that's why I thought I should write the book. I wanted to explain my life's journey, and why I think I'm a better radical today, because I made that journey, because I saw it from the inside. You know, Harvey Milk was a Goldwater Republican,
right? Yeah.
And a naval officer like me, we all had some little
thing
going on.
Worked on Wall Street and...
Worked on Wall Street. And you know what did it for both of us, really?
I'm afraid...
Theater. No, not that too, but...
we'll stick with theater.
Yeah, we'll stick with theater. I fell in with a theater troupe that was doing a Chekhov play in Atlanta because the guy who was the star had picked me up, and there was this party after the opening night, and I looked around the room, and there was this amazing variety of humanity, young and old, gay and straight. They all loved each other. They joked about their romantic misadventures, whatever they were. It was the world as it should be. And it was very, very clear to me, that vision. Harvey toured with the cast of Hair, which probably took care of it quicker. He was a producer of Hair, and
so the thing that comes through so well in the book is this struggle to come to terms with the fact that your family and you took great stock in keeping secrets. Secrets is a huge, huge theme in the book.
Yeah.
And it's a huge theme in your writing throughout. People's secrets revealed, the toxicity of it, sometimes the necessity of them, but ultimately the necessity to reveal them. So, and you do reveal, as a good storyteller, you tease on the page two and then reveal somewhere in one of the sort of foundational secrets in your family, which you may want to share here, but I also want to just ask you just generally, if you recognize that as a real sort of leitmotif in yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What could be more perfect than National Coming Out Day? Mm-hmm. We don't need one day for National Coming Out. It should be done all the time, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. It's not a... it's lovely to to recognize the concept. That was at the bottom of everything Harvey said. Come out wherever you are, because that was the thing. We realized that it was what was poisoning us. The notion that we had to keep the secret at any cost and lower our voices. in Raleigh, when I recently did my appearance, that was, talk about surreal. Everyone in my high school class, it seemed, it was about 200 people in the bookstore, and among them my brother and his wife, who, and we are, things are a little strained now in the Trump sense of life today. Very strained. In fact, sort of a divorce. Jesse Helms' daughter came to the site, waited for my autograph. Jesse Helms, who ended up being my, you know, he was the person that tried to stop Tales of the City from going on PBS. That was the burr up his butt that year.
And we should say he was kind of a mentor of yours early on.
Yes,
and invited
yeah.
Him
I don't want to spoil it. I want yeah. them to. Right. Yeah.
But he had looked with favor on your early life. Put it that
he
way.
He told me I was the hope of the future.
And how right he was.
And he gave me my first writing job, basically, there at the TV station. And here's his daughter, and I said, really nice to see you, Jane. You've got a daughter yourself, right, who lives with her wife just up the street here? Matter of record. They got some kids. And she said, yes, she's gay. It takes a long time for things to soak in the South, you know. Nicest person, I should say. I thought about it afterwards. I thought, that's terribly brave. Really, that she came there that night, and what's the difference between us? We both had fathers that were monsters. Mine was a little more attractive and lovely, funny. I think a lot of his outspoken nature I got, to give my old dad some credit. Jesse arrived at my father's funeral 10 years ago before I did. Jane, the daughter, said, we wanted to stick around. I kept asking Daddy if we could stay, but he was in his wheelchair by then, and he was tired, and he said, I want to get the hell out of here. And so we just missed each other.
What would you have said had you seen him?
How's that lesbian granddaughter coming along? If you remember, he said he called Roberta Actenberg that damn lesbian on the floor of the Senate. He was right in there. Just time to call a spade, a pervert is a pervert. I don't know. I won't tell it because it's in the book, and there's a good story about how I got sent off to a Ku Klux Klan rally and. I'm spoiling it already.
Yeah. The good tease.
But that's where I first saw his homophobia in all its blazing glory.
Yeah.
And I thought even then, where did this come from?
Yeah. But it's something that you kind of recognized in your family as well. I mean, you make really clear, and you speak of it as well in the documentary that was made about you that came out this year, really how easy it is to internalize that fear, the kinds of the phrases that need to be whispered, the toxic shame.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much of a Southern thing, too.
Yeah, although I'm sure there are many in this room who would also say
yeah.
maybe in subtler ways that
yeah,
it's pervasive. So...
Are you angling towards my grandfather? Do you want me
to tell that
part?
Okay. Only if you want to. I did want to come back to this question though of secrets, because at some point there must have been either a conversation or a revelation of some kind where you realized it was safe to say either to somebody I'm gay, or because you got a response that you didn't expect. At what point did that door crack open where you realized I'm not, you know, the wrath of God isn't going to come and smite me?
San Francisco was the main thing. Famously, a friend of mine, when I got drunk on Mai Tais and came over to her house, when I said, "I'm there's something I have to tell you. I'm homosexual." And she came over and took my hand in hers and looked at me and said, "Big deal. Half the people in San Francisco are gay." So that was the big one. And something that's not in the memoir that you just made me think of was there was a really nice guy that worked at the newspaper in Charleston where I was working before I came out here. And I liked him a lot and decided I would just tell him that I was gay. And he said he could totally relate to it because he had a wife who was 15 years older than he was. And he was ostracized terribly for it. Hmm. We've all got something.
Yeah.
We've all got something.
And by the same token, when you decided to open that, to sort of stop telling that secret, boy, did you do it big time.
I told every damn person.
And you started to write immediately.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about that sort of, it's one thing to say to one's friends or one's parents. In this case, you actually couldn't come out to your parents that early on, but pretty much everyone in your life here in San Francisco, you were open. But what was it that allowed you to sort of go whole hog toward that, and how did it change the way you thought of yourself?
I guess it was Anita Bryant. Mm. Yes. There's a lot of leakage in this book. I was working at the Chronicle when the story came over the wire services that she'd started the Save Our Children campaign, and I was immediately thinking, what can I do to fight this? And then I realized in a flash that I had established a character in Tales of the City, Michael Tolliver, who was the son of Florida orange growers.
This was utterly
coincidental.
Why did you make him the son of Florida orange?
Because
growers?
It was far enough away from North Carolina that I wouldn't quite be outing myself. I made him a little lower class than I was. I think that really was the reasoning.
It was close enough to North Carolina.
It was close
that you felt
enough,
comfortable, but far enough that they couldn't say, "Oh,
yeah,
that's his alter ego." Huh.
And then I realized I could have his mother join the Save Our Children Foundation and write him a letter about it, totally clueless about her gay son, as she would be because he wasn't being any more open to his family than I was. And so it was a godsend.
Yeah, and that's what led to, really, in some ways, the most famous few paragraphs of yours, the letter to Mama, in which Michael Tolliver comes out to his parents in a letter from San Francisco that was, maybe nobody knew it at the time except you and your own family, that this was your coming out to them.
Yeah, it was. I knew that they would know. It was just too personal. And I needed to say it because my mother was ill, basically not far from dying of cancer. And I wanted her to know because she's such a worrier her whole life, and I talk about that in the book, about all the things she was trying to get right about me so I wouldn't be hurt. I don't think you should spend so much time with your friend Eddie because he's kind of sissy and people might get the wrong idea. I just like going to the movies with him. I had no idea that he was kind of sissy. She took on everything of her children. You know, she was always worried about them. And I wanted her to know the truth, that what I was, what I had understood about myself, was the light and the joy of my life. I meant it then, I mean it now. And when she said to me, we got to talk about it some more after I was out, she said, "I'm just afraid it'll hurt your career." And I said, "It is my career." I knew that then. I knew it. So the whole process was about trying to make them see that.
Which you think she did in her own way?
Yes, she did. You know, she. It doesn't spoil too much to say that when she was I saw her for the last time in her hospital room. She told me to come back early in the morning because she had an orderly she wanted me to meet. She was getting everything in order, you know.
Making sure you were set. It's a very fond portrait of your mother, and despite your righteous anger, and maybe still there about your father, it actually also is. There is affection there,
and I think.
With your dad, even though it's easy to portray him in a way as one of the villains. Did you struggle with how to navigate that line between, you know, you have to essentially out him as a bigot?
You have to use his language, and everybody who knew him knew that's the way he talked, you know. And much of the South talked that way. I mean, we gloss it over now, and we say the N-word, and we don't want to, we don't want to speak in that ugly language.
And we use the euphemism. We don't, yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
The N-word euphemism.
Right.
It's kind of important to remember how ugly it was and still is, by the way. Mm-hmm. Still is. We just realized that I feel so ignorant in some ways to realize the people, Trump supporters, had spent 8 years hating a black man, hating him. And Trump's task has now been to undo every single thing that this wise, kind, generous man brought to America. Mm. And we're watching him just tick them off. So I'm sorry. It's terrible, isn't it? Yeah.
Well,
we've got
these are the times that we live in. And I think... The book, in some ways, is also, as so much of your writing has been, a kind of a peon, if that's the right word, a bouquet to the safe haven that San Francisco is. But
yeah.
Even we're not safe. Yeah,
I'm going to say sukkah. I don't want to the sukkah. It was my sukkah. It was my safe place. I saw it immediately. That's why I invented 28 Barbary Lane. I thought, I want to have a place where people feel safe and cozy and connected to the world.
Mm, that's a really lovely image. I want to also ask you to talk a little bit about, since it's National Coming Out Day, there's also been a theme in your public expression, your life, where you've really wanted people who are in positions of visibility to own it, to come out, to say, I'm queer. And that's sometimes gotten you into some hot water. You write
a
little...
Yes, it has. Yeah. It still does. I mean, I don't do it a lot. It's exhausting. I've lost people that were potentially friends because I just made it clear to them that I thought they needed to take care of that. And it's just how I feel about them. I don't have respect for people who do that. There's less of it now than there was before, but I don't... In the midst of the AIDS, when that was ravaging the city, to see people being precious about that, hiding it.
You talk a lot about your friendship, acquaintanceship, flings with Rock Hudson.
It was a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really a fling. I mean, it was play. It was what boys do sometimes.
And that said, when you were asked toward the end of his life, or maybe it was after he died or was gravely ill, by a magazine to confirm, so to speak, that he was gay.
I was asked by Randy Schiltz, who was working at the Chronicle. Randy, who, interestingly, when the outing controversy started, said he was strictly opposed to it. But in fact, the outing happened in the Chronicle when Randy Schiltz called and asked me if I would talk about my friendship with Rock, and that gave them the headline. The press needed a way to talk about what everyone knew in a civilized way, and I knew that I was the person to do it because I stop having any shame about being gay myself. I was his friend. And I knew that he needed rescuing from the tabloids because they were already doing, you know, the lethal kiss with, what's her name, from Dynasty.
Linda Evans.
Yeah, and the people around Rock were old school queens that whose whole job had been to cover up for him. And they were now saying that he'd been on a watermelon diet, that he had anorexia, anything, but they had no dignified way into the truth. I realized they didn't. And so I told Randy that I would talk to him, and I did. And the old guy that ran the flower shop down on Castro Street clucked his tongue at me as I walked past, and a columnist in the BAR said, "What kind of a friend would do that?" Well, a friend that doesn't think being gay is the worst thing in the world.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer Armistead Maupin, whose new memoir is Logical Family. He's joined in conversation by Peter Stein. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I won't go into any of the others. Eventually it all works out because they come out, they marry their longtime love, and everybody gets to celebrate them, and no one remembers that they spent many, many years avoiding that subject.
Right. Well, I think that's what's in a way hard to remember at the time. There still wasn't a good way of talking about it, and there still was a huge amount of shame that was, and I think it took a tremendous amount of courage in a way for you to not only be so, to be so without shame, but also perhaps, did you know that you were risking friendships or that people would ostracize you?
Oh, I was scared to death. I knew what I was doing, and I was scared to death. And I knew I was doing it for all my friends who had died and had been perfectly open about their own being gay and having AIDS and everything else. He's got this terrible disease, and still the big secret is the fact that he's gay, you know. I had gay men say to me, "Oh, it's too bad we couldn't have persuaded the world that he was straight, because then people would have cared about AIDS." Mm. Well, that's just a heartbreaking thing to say, but it shows you where we were. Mm-hmm. And I was really worried. I had lost contact with the castle, as Rock's world was known as, and I didn't know. I was worried about what the response had been and to what degree he had suffered. I knew that the 30,000 letters came to the hospital, telling him they loved him exactly the way he was, which was a shock to him. He thought it would all be over. And I know that his biographer said to me when she arrived at my house, "Rock said you were the first person I should talk to." So he got it. And now the world gets it, because all we ever think about is how brave he was to be out, but he wasn't.
He wasn't, yeah. The world has changed, though, and it's a lot easier for younger people, even those in the public eye, to be out and creative and role models, but I'm wondering, what do you see as some of the challenges to be knocked down? Whether it's, I'm not talking about necessarily, or maybe I am talking about legal challenges, but I'm thinking more cultural acceptance. Are we in the golden age now where everybody can be without?
We are. If you don't live in the Middle East or in Africa or in Chechnya,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are atrocities happening all over the world to LGBT people, and I think, you know, we have to offer help outwards in that way. I'm so happy that the Gay Men's Chorus has got their tour right now, the Lavender Pen tour going all over the South. That offers strength to queer kids in those places. I don't know if it's ever going to change the mind of the bigots that are making life hell for queer kids, or the churches that use it as a way to raise money because they can scare people with it.
Right, or a government that still holds up barriers to trans folks. The one last area that I want to talk about before we take audience questions is there's something quite touching in the book where you you had a friendship with Christopher Isherwood and still do have with his longtime husband or partner from the time, Don Bacardi. And you are now the age that Isherwood was when he wrote diaries that sort of, in a way, helped us understand his role as a kind of a gay elder, or I don't forget the term that you used for him almost jokingly.
Well, I didn't use it. He did. He had these amazing diaries that he kept for years, and Don, his partner, has released them a bit at a time. And I've been nervous because the ones that I might be in hadn't been published yet, you know. So I'm remembering a story about Gore Vidal, who had published a memoir, and he in the index where he had the names of all the people who were in the book, he had written a marginal notation in the book that he gave to Norman Mailer, which just said, "Hi, Norm," knowing that Mailer would go to the index and say, "Where am I?" That's exactly what I did. I stood at a bookstore and went, and I know that now that when one of the most thrilling nights of my life was when I got to introduce Isherwood at Norse Auditorium when he was in town making a speech. And Isherwood wrote, "Armistead Maupin laid it on a little thick last night, trying to make me sound like America's old Mr. Queer." Well, that's what he was to me, you know. And he said, I don't think he's a false flatterer. I think we're going to be friends. And we did become wonderful friends. And Don, to this day, still is my guide for, you know, moving forward into life. He's 10 years older than I am, so... I love having someone like that in my life, and that's what Chris and Don did. The people who came to see them at the house were every age, and there would be porn actors and David Hockney and, you know, you name it, they were there.
So that's one of the things that, I mean, you are seen, for better or for worse, and maybe it's a mantle that you don't like, in a way as now you're one of the... And I say this with respect and admiration, but you are one of the elders. You're one of the voices. And I'm wondering if that's very uncomfortable
sometimes.
For you. Yeah.
Sometimes. The wisdom of Isherwood is right there in the diaries. I know I have to get rid of my senile resentments. I thought, oh, I have those. The young need encouraging, and that's my job to encourage them. He says it in the diary. Mm. The other night at the Y in New York, at the 92nd Street Y speakers program. That would be a whole different thing, wouldn't it? I was with Jonathan Groff at the Y.
Cue the village people. Yeah.
Yeah, it's H-A.
Right, know. Of course, yes. Hey, we have fun, too.
All good speakers programs are run by Jews, all of them, I can tell you right now.
So, yes, back at the 92nd Street Y, on stage
on
with
stage,
Jonathan.
On stage, Jonathan did that with me in a nice, really nice way, and I felt myself squirming a little bit and trying not to. And it's distracting when there's that much beauty right in your face saying such nice things. But I told him later, in fact, maybe I told him on stage, that I want to be a big boy and give that right back, you know. Isherwood did it with me and with a lot of people.
Yeah.
He was in the phone book. If you wanted to look up Christopher Isherwood, you could find him in the Santa Monica phone book. You can still find Don in the Santa Monica phone book.
And do you take that responsibility seriously in kind of like transmitting queer culture or just yourself? You're willing to be a mentor?
No, of course. You know, and any time it arises in life, mostly it's with friends, you know. We can be very useful to each other intergenerationally as queers. It's wonderful to have somebody older or younger that you can talk to. One of the biographies of Chris really upset Don because it said his friends got younger and younger the older he got. I thought, well, is there a problem there? I mean, I hear people talking about, oh, we neglect our senior, you know, our elders, and that's certainly true to a certain degree. But I think when young people find out what there is that you can get out of older people, and vice versa, only good things happen.
Well, on that note, there are probably many young people, but also co-generationists in the house. And maybe some wise elders.
He's trying to say old people like me.
Well, like me too.
Like us.
But this may be a good point to see if we have some questions and thoughts for Armistead.
Just getting to a comparison of writing fiction versus writing about your own life. I mean, we all hope that you get as much joy out of doing the writing as we do reading about it. Could you speak to comparing whether you get pleasure or stress out of writing with fictional characters versus writing with real people, and does it help if the real people are living or dead?
It helps if your parents are dead. I think I wrote a book that my parents would love. My father actually liked an autobiographical book I wrote that talked about his father's suicide. He was glad to have it out there and not to have to talk about it, you know, just there in the book. I wish I had encouraging news about my writing process. I mean, it's all hard for me. I work very slowly. And
that hasn't always been the case. I mean, I know with Tales you had to knock out.
I had to, yeah. I had to write 800 words a day. And I got to go back and clean it up or dirty it up, as the case may be, when it was no longer in the Chronicle. So I guess you're asking, what's the difference? It wasn't that different for me because I was simply using my own life as subject matter. And I used some of the manipulative techniques that I use in fiction. Anybody who tells you that a memoir is exactly the way it happened is lying to you. Who could remember such things? Who could reconstruct complete conversations from 50 years ago? You can remember the gist of it. I had real guidance when I was writing this from a book called The Art of Memoir by Mary Carr, who wrote The Liars Club. Mm-hmm. She's kind of the queen of memoir now. And she takes 10 memoirs that she loves, and it's all over the place. It's Nabokov and Tim O'Brien. I'm not going to remember them, but she analyzes what she loves about each one, and what she stresses is, in each case, you're hearing their voice. You know who they are. So that's what I tried to do. I've always tried to do that. I've always wanted my voice to be heard through my characters, at least.
The Chronicle, it was written, the things that you wrote, were they thinly veiled characters from San Francisco? Were they pulled right out of politics in San Francisco? How close were they to some of the people that were there at that time?
The society columnist, Prue Giroux, was inspired by Pat Montandon, right? Little murmur of, we're Facebook friends these days, Pat and I. She's 88. She's always been an amazing self-invented creation and really a lovely person. And I got too close to some of her earnest efforts. She had a round table discussion, and these society ladies would come. And those of you who've seen the first series know that she rings this little bell and she says, "Today we're going to rap about rape." And it was like so well intended because it was addressing the issue that was finally getting talked about. But she was very upset with me. And nowadays, if you buy one of Pat's four memoirs, you will see on the jacket of the book that it says Pat Montandon as immortalized by Armistead Maupin in Tales of the City. It's amazing how we've just come full circle and kind of lovely. I actually got her on Facebook, and suddenly there were all these adoring people that remembered her from when she ran the Pat's afternoon movie on KRON or something. She was remember that? Yeah, a beautiful woman, still a beautiful woman. And I changed it to Prue Giroux in the. In the Pat Montandon became Pam Fontainebleau in the newspaper, which was a little too close for comfort, I guess. There were others, the Father Patty Starr, the very flouncy Catholic priest with the TV show, was inspired by a real-life very flouncy priest with a TV show.
And I think all of the people in your, all of the young straight women in your life felt that they were somehow the model for
Marianne.
For Marianne.
I mentioned a few in the book because they really were. In those days, I didn't know how to make friends with gay men, you know, in the light of day. and so my friends were women, and we'd talk about men together. And so they were important to me, very important.
So while there may not be a perfect key to the Romana clay that some of your early books may be, what's wonderful about this book is that it's so honest in both your being willing to name the people who influenced you in your life, for better or for worse, and in speaking to the truth of how you came to be who you are. And I thank you for that, and thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you, Peter. I've had a great time.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer Armistead Maupin, whose new memoir is Logical Family. He was joined in conversation by Peter Stein. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.